Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extraordinary statement by the nation's former top intelligence official, General James Clapper, who said on CNN that Vladimir Putin might as well be Donald Trump's case officer and Trump Putin's asset. Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the U.S. government's Special Operations, Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies, who is the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election, joins us. We will discuss the race to get the secret information about Trump and the extent to which Putin owns and controls him out to the public via the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation before Trump finds a way to fire Mueller and the Republicans close down the congressional investigations into Russia's interference in our elections. Then we'll speak with Morris Pearl, the former managing director of BlackRock, Inc., who serves as chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of 200 high net worth Americans committed to building a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation. We will discuss today's passage of the Republican tax bill in the House and Morris Pearl's belief that, quoting him, "This bill isn't just cruel, it's un-American. No one in their right mind could possibly believe that the middle class has too much and the rich and powerful have too little in today's America." Then finally, we'll address the blatant stealing of the recent election in Honduras by President Juan Orlando Hernandez and the craven acceptance by the U.S. government of this illegitimate, corrupt, authoritarian leader with ties to drug traffickers. Silvio Carrillo, a freelance film and news producer who has an op-ed at the International New York Times, America's Blind Eye to Honduras's Tyrant, joins us. He is the nephew of the environmental activist Berta Cáceres, whose murder has been covered up by Hernandez, and we will discuss how instability in Honduras will lead to more Hondurans heading to the United States for safety, in spite of Trump's promise to build a wall. And joining us now is Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the U.S. government Special Operations, Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq, Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Malcolm Nance.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. And I imagine you're working on a sequel because it's hard to keep up with all of this stuff that's going on, right?
Well, in fact, ever since I wrote Plot to Hack America about 15 months ago, I've been compiling information for the sequel. Mm-hmm. And like Plot to Hack America, that was an intelligence analysis of what had to be. And just turned out to be identical to everything that the CIA had assessed. With the sequel book, which is going to be about a plot to destroy democracy and how the United States is now one of the pillars in an axis of autocracies around the world that don't believe liberal American democracy is a viable system of government. They believe money is.
Well, that's what's happened, I think, and is happening. We're in the process of, at the very least, we're in the process of losing any kind of national consensus over what is true and what is real. And that is clearly a tactic and technique that's been borrowed by Bannon and company from Putin, who's what they call a political technologist. Surkov invented this idea of confusion. Nothing is true and everything is possible. And that's been translated and transported to the United States thanks to Rupert Murdoch and Fox News. So you have 30 to 40% of the American people inside a bubble that is immune to truth and evidence. And to my mind, you know, whether that's autocracy or not, it's certainly Orwellian and I think tragic.
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, none of this is new. It's just the technologies that have made the transport this belief system, this bubble, now on a very, very broad scale. That's what's new. Many of these concepts, which are executed by Vladimir Putin and his philosopher Surkov and Dugin, Alexander Dugin, are all communist-based. These are very old, you know, former Soviet Union beliefs that the West itself was a failed system of government and that what you needed to do was transport an ideology over that by co-opting the populations that were susceptible to your propaganda. So those systems have been in place for decades and decades. It's just with the fall of the Soviet Union, the rise of Russia as a, you know, the Russian Federation as a new empire with money, real Western levels of capitalist of income, you can just remove communism from that ideological template, replace that with this sort of neo-Russian imperialism, and the belief that money is now the vehicle, the prime mover, the vehicle in which everyone will respond to you. Then even a third-rate country like Russia can rise to the top of the global, you know, ideological spectrum by essentially pushing out through modern technology this belief system that, you know, that autocracies with, you know, that are cash-based are better than, you know, the failed American democratic system. It's brilliant if you think about it, because you get to actually do this and be successful with this by harnessing the tools of democracy, free speech, national elections where everybody votes, and you can actually damage democracy or do away with democracy by essentially buying it through the medium of, you know, of money, by harnessing social media and technology to eliminate your own system of government. It's fascinating if you think about it.
Well, that's what Putin's done. He calls it a controlled democracy, where you have the patina of and the vestiges of democracy and freedom, but in reality, it's a kleptocracy. And by the way, it's a very right-wing religious nationalist kleptocracy. Not that I think Putin himself is personally religious, but he appeals to the church, and he's given the Orthodox Church an enormous amount of importance in Russian society. And that leads me to this extraordinary question of why don't American leftists see Putin for who he is, which is a far right wing religious nationalist along the lines of Rick Santorum, as well as being pro-fascist in terms of who he supports in Western Europe?
Well, I think most people on the left do see that. As a matter of fact, you see this backlash where the people who are trying to uphold the precepts of democratic government and, you know, this opposition to Russia are the left. Now, there is an extreme libertarian left. These are people who are so far to the left that they come back around to the right, who believe that, you know, nothing is right, and they support Jill Stein, who, by the way, was under the control of Vladimir Putin. I won't say direct control, but certainly under the influence of Vladimir Putin, and worked, you know, to a certain extent, gave Donald Trump a lot of cover in the last election, to the point where the Russian Green Party begged the American Green Party to not have anything to do with Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, and they scoffed it off. They wanted to essentially have the United States government become so bad that people would see the Green Party as a viable alternative to the progressive left. All of that being said, you know, the mainstream left have reversed roles with the old Cold War hawk, who always saw, you know, Russia and communism as bad. Now, as you say, there's this religious nationalism that sprouted in Russia that Putin caught on to very early after the fall of the Soviet Union. And he's now propelled Russia to be sort of the ideological center of the Western Christian conservative world. And you see all these American, you know, conservative politicians going to Russia, I mean, over the last 10 years, and most notably the last 3 years, going to Russia and seeing them as ideological soulmates. That's fascinating. These were people who were hardcore calling people commies and, you know, death to Reds and all of those things. They have now completely flipped, and they see Putin's Russia as a spiritual base, to the point where they see no problem and what Russia has done in attacking the United States with this cyber warfare operation. And they see Russia's support of Donald Trump as equal to their own support to the point where I think Vladimir Putin has something like a 69% approval rating amongst the conservative right in the United States. And, you know, I believe Barack Obama had something like 10%. So that just goes to show how this sort of psychological warfare judo has worked its magic once Russia changed from the stripes of the communist Soviet Union into this, like, you know, as you call it, you know, a religious nationalist-based kleptocracy, which is, you know, technically a fascist nation, right? What does Mussolini call a fascist nation? A dictatorship of the corporate right. Well, this is what's happened. And now they are strong enough, at least in terms of ideology and co-opting through democratic means, Americans who are more than willing to allow, you know, to trust a former director of the KGB, right, former KGB officer and director of Russian intelligence, over anyone on the American left, no matter how patriotic and loyal.
And again, I'm speaking with Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the U.S. government, Special Operations, Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq, Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. So you just mentioned how the American right is in bed with Putin. The most shocking thing of all, of course, is that the president of the United States, Donald J. Trump, could well be Putin's asset. And I'm not making that up, because the former top intelligence officer in the country, the director of national intelligence, General James Clapper, said as much in an interview on CNN on Monday. Let's just play a clip of what James Clapper said in response to a question from Jim Suter of CNN about the friendly phone calls between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin.
You heard the president's speech today. He calls out Russia and China, describes them as rival powers to the U.S., but also says he wants to build a great partnership with them, and then had all this friendly stuff to say about his phone calls with Vladimir Putin this week. Is that a contradictory message?
Well, it is to me. I think this past weekend is illustrative of what a great case officer Vladimir Putin is. He knows how to handle an asset, and that's what he's doing with the president.
You're saying that Russia is handling President Trump as an asset?
That's the appearance to me. So, you know, we've shared intelligence with the Russians for a long time. We've always done that, although my experience with them has been pretty much of a one-way street, where we provide them intelligence and we don't get much back. And oddly enough, my first exposure to that was in the early 90s, when I served as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and we were trying to engage the Russians on, of all places, North Korea, and didn't get much back from them. So I think what we did is the right thing. Certainly when people's lives are at risk, that we do have a duty to warn. And so the intelligence community, CIA, did the right thing here. And I thought, in a rather theatric gesture, the phone call to thank President Trump for something that kind of goes on at levels below the radar and is not all that visible.
I just want to be clear here, though. You're saying that Russia is treating the president of the United States as an asset.
I'm saying this figuratively. Mm-hmm. I think you have to remember Putin's background. He's a KGB officer. That's what they do. They recruit assets. And I think some of that experience and instincts of Putin is coming to play here in his managing a pretty important account for him, if I could use that term, with our president.
Malcolm Nance, what did you think of that exchange with General Clapper? Because frankly, it's just extraordinary. It's so out there that for all to see that the top intelligence officer, or the former top intelligence officer in the country, is telling the American people that their president is, to put it bluntly, Putin's bitch.
Well, you know, a few minutes later, he did come back and say that he was speaking figuratively. But, you know, it's not an assessment that is unheard of, and certainly that hasn't been spoken of. I know I wrote that exact assessment, Plot to Hack America, in 2016. You know, there's a difference, though. I mean, I think he was using it in the terms not of actual tradecraft, but he was using it in terms of a politician who was so easily influenced, so easily led around by the nose ring, that he has become essentially an asset for Russia because Russia knows how to manipulate Donald Trump. My assessment was a lot further on, and I think we're going to, you know, the evidence is starting to become clearer. My assessment is that he was an unwitting asset, that he was essentially a puppet under, you know, Vladimir Putin's control from as far back as 2013, based on all the readings we got about his behavior at Miss Universe and how Russia has essentially managed to co-opt him and get him to believe in their worldview and not the traditional American worldview that has existed since World War II. You know, with the dissolution of NATO, the breaking up of the European Union, taking America out of all global trade agreements. None of this benefits America. All of it benefits Russia. That requires some level of manipulation, whether overt or covert. On the other hand, when Donald Trump became very aware that Russia was doing things in their interest, particularly on July 27th of 2016, when he made his statement, "Russia, if you're listening, please release the 33,000 hacked Hillary Clinton emails," then I assess he became a winning asset. He knew Russia was now working in his interest. And I believe from that point onward, he not only knows Russia is out to help him, he is openly and gladly accepting their assistance, as based on the phone call that Michael Flynn was now arrested, indicted, and pled guilty on, you know, speaking to the Russian foreign minister for lying to the FBI, and Trump's passionate embrace and almost obsequious, not almost, total obsequiousness to Vladimir Putin about anything. He never insults the man. He always agrees with Putin. And when Putin makes a phone call to Trump or releases it to the news media that Trump has done something positive, Trump gushes. And
right.
Any other person in the United States would have been investigated over these ties, and now Donald Trump is being investigated as well.
Well, but that leads you to the question of how long will this investigation go on? Obviously, Fox News is orchestrating a campaign to smear Special Counsel Mueller, and it does feel as though at any moment Trump could fire Robert Mueller, and it may be a good time over the holidays to do so. What's your sense on whether that's in the cards?
Well, I mean, that would be cataclysmic. That would be tantamount to declaring war on the the Constitution of the United States. There's a lot of rumors that have been swirling around, you know, the D.C. this week and in the news media that Trump was going to try to pull some fast removal of a regulation that would allow him to directly fire Mueller, as opposed to having the Deputy Attorney General, Rob Rosenstein, fire him, or fire Sessions, appoint an interim, and the interim would no longer be recused, and he would fire Rosenstein, then fire Mueller. Mm-hmm. All of these things, I mean, they're all within the realm of possibility, but that would be an admission of guilt. I mean, the only thing you could say is, you fired an attorney, you fired a director of the FBI, you fired an attorney general if he does that, and now you went down the chain of command, fired a deputy attorney general, and then fired the guy who was investigating you. You're clearly guilty of something. All of the information from the Mueller investigation would fall out of trucks on pallets in front of the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I think we'd be within a constitutional crisis and an impeachment within weeks.
Well, will then the evidence ever get out? I mean, I wish Clapper could go public with what he knows, because he's not going out on a limb. He's not saying that Putin is Trump's case officer and he's essentially a Russian asset. He wouldn't make a statement like that, I don't think, unless he knew what's going on. So my frustration is, you know, I get all these angry letters saying, where's the evidence? This, by the way, is the mantra on RT. Where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? Where's the proof? Well, do you think Robert Mueller is going to deliver the evidence that we need? Because it's going to have to be pretty strong to get the Fox News viewers to believe that Trump is, shall we say, in collusion, to use that rather amorphous term, with Russia?
Well, collusion is a really horrible word here because people are trying to use it in a common vernacular. Mueller has already made it clear what the terms he's operating on are, and that is conspiracy against the United States. It was the first charges filed against Gates and Paul Manafort in their money laundering trial. He used the power of the FBI for lying to a federal agent against Papadopoulos and Michael Flynn to get them to plead guilty. And now, you know, the problem is people want to use the word evidence. Evidence is a legal term. What you have been getting over the last year, including my own assessment, was intelligence. Intelligence is not legal until it is in the hands of the Justice Department. Mueller has evidence. He has already attained two convictions, right? Because confessing and pleading guilty is a conviction. Mike Flynn is now a convicted felon. So is George Papadopoulos. And now he has two indictments for massive amounts of money laundering. So that being said, this is considered the lowest hanging fruit in this investigation. These people are now making the case. And as a jurist said on television the other day, he is doing a classic mafia style criminal organization trial. And like those mafia trials, you don't see the evidence until the story is over, right? You can gain inference at what the evidence is on the basis of who he's going after and who he's convicted.
Well, just in the last minute, you brought up Jill Stein, and this Senate Intelligence Committee is going to be interviewing her. Clearly, I think, I'm pretty sure she was what the Russian KGB call a useful idiot. I don't know that she was actively knowing how much she was being manipulated. But she did deliver more votes or took more votes away from Hillary Clinton in those three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, to cause Hillary Clinton's loss. So if the Russians invested in her along with their other activities, it was a hell of a good investment.
Well, you know, in the sequel of The Plot to Hack America, I'm writing about what I call the dinner table, which was at the 10th anniversary of Russia Today. They had Vladimir Putin seated at the head of the table, of the table of the guest of honors. And to his right hand was Michael Flynn. But also at the table was Jill Stein and the father of Julian Assange. Now, I find all three of these characters very fascinating, all of whom are useful idiots. And to paraphrase John Brennan, the former director of the CIA, most people, when they're committing treason, aren't aware they're committing treason when you're being manipulated by a foreign intelligence agency.
Well, Malcolm Nance, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Malcolm Nance, a career counterterrorism and intelligence officer with the U.S. government, Special Operations, Homeland Security, and Intelligence Agency, who has over 33 years of experience in combating radical extremism. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq, Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires about the Republicans' tax bill, which is not just cruel, but un-American.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides.
I'm at home in the streets of Rome.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Maurice Pearl, the former managing director of BlackRock, Inc., who serves as chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of 200 high-net-worth Americans who are committed to building a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maurice Pearl.
Great to be in your show, Ian.
Well, thank you, Maurice. And the Republican tax bill has passed the House. It's just up for the Senate now for a final vote. And the president, of course, is eager to sign it. So it is pretty much a done deal. But it does feel like at the last minute, it sort of got sleazier and sleazier. Have you figured out what happened there with Bob Corker? A deal was obviously made, was it not?
Well, I mean, nothing's obvious. I don't read people's minds. But we did send out a piece explaining that somehow he was a no and he became a yes.
Mm-hmm.
An additional provision was put in, making a huge benefit for people who own buildings where they rent out commercial office space, which includes a building he owns in Tennessee.
Well, but
he has a limited partnership there. And,
right. But isn't that same gift in the new tax bill applicable to Donald Trump?
Sure. Oh, sure. I mean, I think we knew that a major part of this was to benefit, you know, sort of wealthy, non-working real estate developers. They have the position that people voted last November, and they voted to give more money to rich New York real estate developers. And that's what they're doing.
But that's not what he said on the campaign trail. Donald Trump basically ran against Wall Street. He tied Hillary Clinton as a creature of Wall Street. And he ran as a populist, an economic populist, and said he was going to create jobs. He was going to give people the best health care. He wasn't going to touch Social Security and Medicare. He ran further to the left than Bernie Sanders.
True. And I think he's somehow, I don't know. I honestly don't think he really cares one way or the other about most things. I think he just wants to be a winner.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sort of part of the Republican Party, and that's Republicans have wanted to, like, reduce taxes for the rich for many years, and that's what he's doing, and he's winning, and he's going to go on TV and say he won, and he's the greatest, and, you know, he accomplished something, and, yeah, he did. Here he is.
Well, we know that the bill, obviously, is called tax reform, which is a rather obscene misnomer in this case. But
yes,
it is largely to the benefit of the donors, and the trick they had to have was how do we take care of our donors at the same time con our voters? And Senator Lindsey Graham even said quite bluntly that donors had called up and said, if you don't pass this bill, don't call us for money. So that's the external reality here. But what's the internal reality with these guys going back home trying to sell this to their constituents, particularly out here in California? We have 11 Republicans who voted for this bill out of the 14, and it's going to increase people's taxes out here. It's a petty punishment against blue states. It's so partisan. It's just obscene. And, you know, our taxes are going to go up out here because we can no longer deduct state and local taxes. And it's almost a way to punish successful states. It makes no sense. It's the first time I think a tax bill has been so clearly and flagrantly partisan.
Well, it depends how you define successful. They think that Kansas is a bigger success because Kansas, the richest people are getting richer and everyone else is getting poorer. And that's what they think is the right answer for the country. They think California is a gross failure because sort of everyone has jobs, and they're, I don't know. I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous to you and our listeners, but I don't think they define successful the same way that you and I do. I think they think that it's just not right that some people are taxed for the benefit of other people, that the rich pay taxes so the poor can have schools, so the rich pay taxes So there's highways and hospitals and libraries and universities that everyone gets to use. And there's a group of people that just think that's not morally right. That's not what God meant, how God meant the world to work. And they're trying to fix it. And they decided that they're going to do that come hell or high water. And it's, you know, our job to provide the hell and high water between now and next November.
Well, let's get to that. And again, I want to reintroduce Morris Pearl, the former managing director of BlackRock, Inc., who serves as the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of 200 high net worth Americans who are committed to building a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation. And just to finish up on trying to understand the psychology of Republicans, both in the House and Senate, who are voting for this incredibly unpopular bill to, you know, show fealty to their donors. You know, you do have an evangelical wing, obviously, or maybe they've essentially taken over the Republican Party, the Bannon kind of Roy Moore wing, if you will. But there's the prosperity gospel, that's very successful televangelist, Osteen. His mantra is, God doesn't want you to be a whiner, God wants you to be a winner. Now, you're a winner, right? And you and the Patriotic Millionaires go on Capitol Hill and try and lobby these guys. So what's the problem here? Why don't they listen to you? Because you guys are the ones that they're basically enthralled with.
I mean, they listen to us, but they just believe to the bottom of their hearts, or at least the bottom of their wallets, that collecting taxes and running the government is just wrong, and they're trying to end it. They're trying to get rid of it. You know, it's like the famous saying, make government small enough so we can drown in a bathtub. They think that the country made a huge wrong turn in like the 1860s, and they're trying to set it back to the right again. You know, they don't believe that there should be things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and all those other things. You know, if you want to know the psychology of the Republicans, you have to talk to somebody like Kevin McCarthy. He's one of your representatives from California, and he's the one who signed off on this thing.
Sure. Right. By the way, you know, he represents Bakersfield, just north of where I'm speaking to you from. And there was a study recently on ignorance in America, the destruction of public education. And guess which city is the most uneducated in the United States?
Doesn't surprise me at all.
Bakersfield.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. You know, and I think, I mean, and, you know, it's just the same way I don't vote based on what I think will help my income over the next, you know, month or year. Neither do they. They've been convinced not that this is going to help them make more money next year. They've been convinced that somehow this is the right thing to do. And it's morally right. And I think we have to talk about what's morally right and what's evil and how we have to change the direction of the country to be the kind of country where some people help other people, and that's considered okay. That's good.
So you're really basically saying we've got to do start a movement that's kind of the antithesis of Ayn Rand, who, you know, that weird libertarian idea that generosity and helping other people is almost a sin. The selfishness, yeah. Selfishness is a virtue. So is that to say then, to combat the evangelical right, which has captured the Republican Party, along with the libertarian, like the Koch brothers, etc., do we have to revive the religious left in this country?
I think that would be a good thing to do, because, I mean, I think it used to be the people of religion that talked about more equality and more resources for the poor and were preaching for them. That used to be part of what religion did. Now the Republicans say there's only two things the Pope should talk about, bullying homosexuals and preventing abortion. And those are the only two things that they should be working on. And, I mean, both of those, of course, I disagree with. But I think that we have to make some decisions in our country. And, in fact, the Republicans think we have made a decision, and it's what I think is the wrong decision. It's not just because I'm altruistic, and I do think I care about people, but it's also because I think it's better for everybody. I don't want to live in a country with gross inequality. I don't want to live like in a, when I go on vacation in an island, live behind 12-foot walls and be driven around armored cars. I don't like to do that. I don't want our country to be like apartheid South Africa was. So I'm doing what I think is best for me and my family and everybody.
So is there a way, though, to sort of revive the kind of mythology of American egalitarianism? I mean, something seems to have happened. We've gone from a sharing nation to a selfish nation. And I wonder whether the mythology of, you know, the frontier, how people cooperated and they didn't let their neighbors die of thirst in the desert. I mean, maybe there were also people charging a fortune for the last drop of water. That's obviously a part of the story as well. But my sense is that there is still a kind of egalitarian myth out there, and yet we are becoming the most polarized country in the world, perhaps short of Putin's Russia, yeah, in terms of the distribution of wealth.
Yeah, I mean, that's correct. I think that somehow people have been convinced by the few people that do things like extracting oil and coal from the earth that it's better for everybody to be independent and either succeed or fail in your own, and that, you know, sort of God put this oil and coal under the ground for the benefit of those few who are able to, you know, take over the ownership of the land and extract it. And somehow those people are meant to succeed, and we're not supposed to care about anyone else.
And that's what they call freedom, by the way. That's what the Koch brothers call freedom.
That's exactly what they call freedom. I mean, they've made their money selling things to oil drillers. That's how the Koch fortune was made.
By the way, can I just add something to that, though? Because when you say that's how the Koch fortune was made, Fred Koch, the father of the current Koch brothers, he made his fortune building a oil refinery for Adolf Hitler. The Germans did not have the ability to refine aviation gasoline until Fred Koch brought that technology to Nazi Germany and built that refinery, which enabled the Luftwaffe to fly. And we know what role the Luftwaffe played in World War II. I'm not making this up.
That is true.
You know.
Oh, I know. That is true. That is true, and I'm sure that they are prepared to defend every detail of it. But now, in the present day, they still believe that freedom and a lack of government regulation is what helps people succeed. And yeah, it helps a few people succeed. And if you want a winner-take-all society, then sure, have no regulation, and you'll have a few winners pop up at the top. You know, but I think if you want the kind of society where more than a few people are doing well, then you need what we call government. That's how we do things together, through collective actions. That's why our initial founding fathers created things called commonwealths, because there's things they had to do, and they needed commonwealth to do them. That's what the original 13 colonies were called, was commonwealths.
Well, Morris Pearl, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be in your show, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Morris Pearl, who is the former managing director of BlackRock, Inc., who serves as chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of 200 high net worth Americans who are committed to building a more prosperous, stable, and inclusive nation. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the blatant stealing of the recent election in Honduras and the craven acceptance by the U.S. government of this illegitimate, corrupt, authoritarian leader with ties to drug traffickers.
Politics needs your mind. Politics needs human beings. Politics needs lies.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Silvio Carrillo, who's a freelance film and news producer based in California, whose work has included coverage for CNN, Al Jazeera English, and the South China Morning Post. And he has an op-ed at the International New York Times, America's Blind Eye to Honduras's Tyrant. Welcome to Background Briefing, Silvio Carrillo.
Thanks for having me.
And it's pretty extraordinary that, and brazen, really, how the election results in Honduras in the recent elections were so transparently hacked, shifted, I don't know what the word is, and they clearly don't have any credibility. From what we understand, that the TSE, the Tribunal Supremo Electoral, it's in Honduras. The initial count of 57% of the tally sheets on election night showed a 5-point lead for the opposition candidate Salvador Nasralla. And then the TSE system mysteriously went offline for 30 hours. And when it returned, they reversed the voting trends, eroding Nasralla's lead until Hernandez ends up with 1.7% lead over Nasralla. And this is basically impossible, isn't it? The TSA magistrate Marcos Ramiro Lobo Rosales said that 70% of the tallies had been counted and that Nasralla had an insurmountable lead, and an independent analysis of the vote tabulation by Dr. Ifram Nuruddin of Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service, prepared for the Organization of American States, found that the change in voting trends following the TSE's mysterious system failure was completely improbable.
It's completely shocking. The only thing transparent about this election is the amount of corruption that went into it. The Georgetown study is out there, but the Economist did a study as well. And these are, you know, legitimate people and organizations doing these kinds of studies. And the U.S. State Department and the U.S. ambassador or the charge d'affaires in Honduras is completely ignoring this and ignoring the dozens of deaths that are occurring in Honduras as a result of this fraud election.
And they, to what extent have they endorsed or acceded to this illegitimate president Juan Orlando Hernandez's election, or whatever you want to call it? Obviously, he didn't win. The voting ended. He was way behind, and then suddenly, when they resumed 30 hours later, he's a whisker ahead. I mean, it's pretty flagrant. What are the State Department and the embassy in Honduras saying about the U.S. government's position in terms of acknowledging the presidency of Juan Orlando Hernandez?
Yeah, they've already acknowledged it. They sent out a press release last night saying that the State Department fully accepts the results, the TSE results, the Electoral Commission's results, despite that 30 hours of not knowing what was happening, 30 hours of what seems to be fraud. If the quote system has gone down, then there was supposed to have been some redundancy in that system, and they did it on purpose. They didn't put the redundancy in there because they wanted to change the outcome of the election, and that's what's happened here. And the U.S. government is accepting of this and wholeheartedly embracing Juan Orlando at this point. And right now, the opposition candidate is in Washington, making himself available to them to discuss this situation, because the Honduran people just voted this man out of office, Juan Orlando Hernandez, as well as U.S. policy, this policy that's been around for 80-some-odd years. It has to change. Like when the question I always ask myself is, what does it take? You know, how many people have to die? How many people, like my aunt who are trying to bring change to Honduras, Berta Cáceres, have to die. These are the people that can lead Honduras out of this. They don't necessarily have to be president. They don't have to be vice president. But they need, the people in Honduras need a leader who is going, need heroes. Is this man who just stole this election a hero in Honduras? I don't think so.
And again, I'm speaking with Silvio Carrillo, who's a freelance film and news producer based in California, whose work has included coverage for CNN, Al Jazeera English, and the South China Morning Post. And he has an op-ed at the International New York Times, America's Blind Eye to Honduras's Tyrant. And as Silvio just pointed out, his aunt is Berta Caceres, a well-known environmental activist in Honduras, who was clearly murdered by the military or by the thugs associated with the military. How would you describe the murder of your aunt?
Well, there was a report that recently came out by a group of lawyers, and this independent group of lawyers, they looked at a small amount of the evidence that was made available to them, and they found out that there are ties high up into the Honduran security services. Also, this dam that my aunt was fighting against, which was about to, the Honduran government had taken over this land that belonged to indigenous people, and so she was helping this indigenous organization fight against the government. This dam is owned by one of the wealthiest families in Honduras that has direct ties to this government. And this is typical in Honduras. There's only about 10 to 15 families that own 90% of the land and resources in Honduras. And so this investigation by this group of independent group of lawyers discovered that there are very strong ties to the government and to the security forces in Honduras. And that's why, and we've known this all along, you know, this is not a shock to anyone. Hernandez's government has had years of worth of corruption allegations and evidence and documentation, and they've just been able to completely ignore it because they are propped up by the U.S. government and by this current charged affairs, and the previous ambassador was also supporting this corrupt government of Juan Orlando Hernandez.
But the American position is the hardest part to understand. You've got, as you point out, a few oligarchical families running the country, and it sounds like, you know, sort of something out of a Marquez novel. But the U.S. attitude is so extraordinary. I mean, are we stuck back, almost back in the 1930s with FDR talking about the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua, calling Anastasio Somoza, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. Is that attitude prevailing? Because I thought that things had sort of changed in the 21st century. But has it changed that much? Did it change under Obama? Obviously,
no. It worsened.
It worsened.
That's what started. Unfortunately, that's what happened after the coup in 2009. This right wing group that is currently in office in Honduras made up a reason to create a coup, to pull off a coup in Honduras, in the U.S. fully supported it. Hillary Clinton supported it. The Obama administration went along with this, what was termed an illegal coup. I don't know if there's a legal coup, but it was an illegality, and it was recognized by the Honduran ambassador at the time, Hugo Llorens, who was writing cables back to the State Department saying there's no justification for this coup. But then the U.S. and Hillary Clinton and the Obama administration went ahead and supported it. And that's why we're here today. I mean, if you want to stop immigration and not have to build a wall or not claim to have to build a wall, then let's help these people. Let's help these people with human rights. Let's help them by supporting people who aren't corrupt, who aren't killing their own people, who aren't lining their own pockets. Like, that's the whole point. We've been doing this for 80 years, and it's the same policy. And the Obama administration, the one you'd think would come in and rescue, didn't, exasperated it and made the entire situation worse. And now, somehow we have this we have Trump in the White House. I mean, where do you think this is going to go now?
Well, that's the extraordinary thing. This is another coup, isn't it? I mean, it's a repeat of what you just said.
Absolutely.
Happened under Hillary Clinton. And my only understanding of that, and I didn't really cover it in depth at the time, but the impression was that the U.S., just as they were in Haiti, hysterical about Aristide, they seemed to get hysterical about the candidate who won, but then whose victory was stolen, because they thought he was some kind of reincarnation or a Honduran version of Hugo Chavez. Was that, that's my memory.
Correct. Yeah, no, that's correct. I mean, they're, you know, that aside, it should be completely irrelevant. If you should stand up for democracy, and they're doing the exact opposite. They're standing up for an authoritarian dictator who is taking our taxpayer dollars, U.S. taxpayer dollars, and using and providing his military and his police and his security services with more ammunition, literally more ammunition to kill people protesting against this fraud election. I mean, how does this? I don't. You know, it's mind-boggling. This doesn't make any sense. And in this day and age, the one thing we should be doing, I mean, we're beyond the 80s, we're beyond the Cold War, is trying to support democracies, true democracies. I mean, I would ask the Charge d'Affaires what you would call this.
Well, the other aspect, surely, though, Silvio Carrillo, is that where does the state violence, and as you mentioned, your aunt, Berta Cáceres, was murdered probably by the intelligence services tied to the military. Where is that nexus between organized crime, oligarchical families, and the military? Because Honduras has one of the highest murder rates. I think Venezuela is slightly above it, but it's really up there. And it's all drug-related, at least a lot of it is. So how do you kind of, you know, separate the criminal violence from state violence?
It's you know, I mean, to begin with, I think I would answer that question by saying that the Honduran crime statistics are not reliable. This government took control of them, and there's no way to check to see if what they're saying is true. There are, if you look on their website for their crime statistics, there's some fairly obvious issues with the count, with the numbers that they have there. Yet the U.S. State Department goes by those numbers, uses those numbers, and tells Congress, oh, look how great they're doing. I saw one article yesterday that said it had halved their crime, their homicide rate. This is not true, like simply not true. You wouldn't, like the FBI statistics are always checked out here in the U.S. They've got other methods of their public files. These files are not made public by the Honduran government. And secondly, that nexus of power is been allowed to operate and include the government. There are like Juan Orlando's brother has ties to drug traffickers. The former president's son has been indicted, and I think he's already in jail here in the U.S. in New York for similar charges. And these aren't things that we are making up. These are things that are documented. I mean, the New York Times and other papers have written about these things, and there is clear documentation. Juan Orlando had been stealing money from the Social Security Fund. The Social Security Fund in a third world country. Who does that? Who steals? This is a country that is the second poorest in Latin America. I mean, you have to be incredibly brazen to take that money and use it for your National Party's campaign. It's just shocking the amount of machinations that they are allowed to get away with, all because the U.S. wants to keep control of their bases in Honduras. Now, if you think about it, this is exactly the problem. Like you've got your foothold on Honduras. You're helping this man. You're enabling him to be corrupt and to line his friends' pockets and his own pockets. Why would you stay in this country? My aunt was killed. Why would you stay in that country? Of course you're going to leave. Of course there's a rising number, as a Pew Research study came out earlier this month, saying that refugees from Honduras and the Northern Triangle countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, are rising. Of course they're rising. They're going to run from this horrible person that the U.S. is backing.
Well, isn't it somewhat similar, Silvio Correa, to what's happening in El Salvador with drug gangs? And that's young kids are basically given a choice, join the gang or we'll shoot you.
Right.
And I've seen footage of bodies just lying in the streets in Honduras where people are sort of, pedestrians are strolling by nonchalantly as though it's an everyday occurrence. So just in the last couple of minutes, explain to us, and we get what you're saying. Obviously, Trump doesn't with his stupid wall, and he doesn't understand the connections between his policies and people fleeing the country because their kids can't grow up there and looking for a place to go, and they take a hazardous trip through Mexico to get here.
Right.
We know that's happening, but just in the last couple of minutes, explain to us the connections between drug gangs and the government and our counterintuitive policy.
Well, for instance, there's a lot of activity in trafficking in certain parts of Honduras, and this land is owned. This land where a lot of this occurs is owned by some of these wealthy families, and the government the government gets paid off, or leaders in the government, police are paid off to look the other way. I mean, it's a very kind of simplistic and obvious thing, and so. Part of the reason the U.S. alleges that they want to maintain a foothold in Honduras is to be able to interdict, catch the bad guys who are trafficking drugs. But a lot of those people are involved in the government itself. But an additional issue is that, you know, the DEA isn't exactly being honest in their operations either. There was a report that came out earlier this year, a few months ago, about how the DEA lied about their involvement in an operation in this particular area of northeastern Honduras. And they blatantly lied about their involvement, and where several innocent people were killed who happened to be there at the wrong time. But then the DEA lied about it. And this is all reported. This is all, you know, documented. I mean, I can produce so many links. I don't know what else we can do. It's just the connections are there, and they're obvious, and they're not being paid attention to by the State Department.
Well, Silvio Correa, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Silvio Correa, who's a freelance film and news producer based in California, whose work has included coverage for CNN, Al Jazeera English, and the South China Morning Post. He has an op-ed at the International New York Times, America's Blind Eye to Honduras's Tyrant. And his aunt, Betha Caceres, a well-known environmental activist in Honduras, was murdered by people connected with the government now in power as a result of blatant and flagrant election manipulation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.